students will try just about anything to find a good way to prepare for an exam, including studying mindfulness.
Paying attention to the present moment on purpose in a non-judgmental way.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a look at how test prep is changing. We'll also hear how some New York students published a book to help Alzheimer's research, visit a hospital pathology lab, and spend an academic minute searching for an autism biomarker. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Keeping your mind clear and in the moment could be the best way for a student to prepare for an exam. That's what Logan Thompson writes about in his new book called Beyond the Content: Mindfulness as a Test Prep Advantage. Thompson is an adjunct psychology professor at Endicott College and a test prep instructor. In addition to test prep, he has several years of experience teaching mindfulness meditation. In fact, he lived at a meditation retreat center for 2 years, spending over 5 months on silent retreats. I asked why he started this project.
I was living at the meditation center called Insight Meditation Society for 2 years. This was several years ago. And while I was doing that, I started teaching test prep for a company called Manhattan Prep. And I started noticing a lot of the tools and techniques that I was learning about mindfulness. I started noticing that those could help my students in the test prep classroom. So the wonderful management at Manhattan Prep gave me the green light to start incorporating mindfulness techniques and mental performance techniques into the classroom, and I found that the students were just really receptive and wanted this, what I call the other half of test prep, to be addressed, and that was the birth of the book.
And the title really does seem to describe it, Beyond the Content, because the actual content that you're preparing for doesn't really seem to matter when using your techniques.
That's exactly right. They work in tandem. You can think of athletics. If a person playing, let's say, football or any other sport, if they have all the skills but their body is not conditioned enough to carry out those skills, they're not going to be able to perform well. And vice versa, if their body is peakly conditioned but they don't have the skills, they're not going to be able to perform well. And the same parallel process is happening in test prep and academia. We teach the skills, the content, but if the person's mind, body, emotions are not prepared to handle those in stressful environments, then it doesn't matter how much you've memorized about, let's say, exponents. If you're really stressed and having to work with a lot of difficult thoughts and emotions, your mind's not going to remember all those things about exponents. So we have to address both sides of test prep, the content and the mental, emotional, physical part.
You talk about there being, in your mind, passengers and drivers. Who are these passengers and drivers?
Yeah, this is just a framework to help people get a grasp of navigating the complex inner landscape that we all have. And all the word passengers refers to is those voices in our minds when we're trying to perform something that kind of come in and it seems out of left field. Let's say we're doing a problem and we get the problem wrong. And then there's this voice that says, hey, you got this problem wrong. That means you're going to get the next problem wrong. That means you're not going to get into school. That voice I'm calling a passenger, because it wasn't really invited, and it's kind of trying to be a backseat driver here. So I'm trying to help students be able to name and identify those passengers that come to visit, mainly so that they can notice them and not necessarily take directions from them.
It's interesting. You do talk about a conversation you had with one of your trainees who said, you know, because I'm going to get that problem wrong, my entire life is ruined. And the way, the road she took to get there was interesting.
Yes. There are two things helpful about you saying that. one, when we say it out loud, it's hard not to chuckle. It's hard not to chuckle at that, at the extremity. That said, that leap is not unique to that student. In fact, most students have some form of that leap. It's just not really explicitly stated. So students take that, they operate from that place. So it sounds extreme to say, if I miss this problem, my life is ruined. But what's actually happening in that student and many students' minds is, if I miss this problem, I'll miss the next one, and then the test, and then I won't get into school, and then I won't meet maybe my husband or wife, and then maybe I won't have kids. And all of this spins out of control a little bit subconsciously. So all of a sudden, 10 minutes later on the test, the student is operating from a very fight or flight, stressed out place, all because they didn't recognize that passenger peeking its head up.
Those passengers, those little thoughts, they're just little flickers of thoughts that pop into your head, and you never know when they're just going to die out or turn into a brush fire in your mind, do you?
That's exactly right.
So you've got the passengers. What do the drivers do?
Yeah, so in this framework, this is more of a mental model to help people get a grasp on things. This is not like a neuroscientific truth. But in the framework, the driver, there's only one driver, and that driver is permanent. And the driver is the part of us that always has access to wisdom, compassion, common sense, perspective. And it's always there and in the driver's seat, but it doesn't always have the wheel. Where mindfulness comes in is, it's important to recognize when those voices are popping up, that whether it's a passenger or a driver, and you can definitely recognize which one is which by the type of message it's giving. And there's a chapter called Driver's Ed, which helps people keep the driver in control more often. Now, it's impossible to banish our passengers. That's just parts of our mental stories, and we're going to have voices, but we can start to help figure out who's going to have the wheel most of the time.
And you do have some interesting exercises in the book to try to, you know, either figure it out or at least try to control it a bit.
Right, right. So mindfulness itself, mindfulness practice, which has several definitions, but the definition that I work with is paying attention to the present moment on purpose in a non-judgmental way. And that definition is largely started by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who started the mindfulness-based stress reduction. And with that definition, I have students do mindfulness exercises, which can be as simple as taking 5 minutes and bringing your attention back to your breath over and over again. And that trains the mind to be in the present moment and notice what thoughts and emotions are happening. So once that noticing happens, then students can start to identify the common themes of thoughts and emotions that arise, and they can start to get an idea of their passengers. There aren't infinite passengers. Most of us usually have between 5 to 10 that show up all the time. One theme could be comparing myself to my sibling. One theme could be, if something happens now, then that same thing's going to happen in the future. That's what we were talking about earlier. If I miss this problem, I'll miss the next one. And then I tell students to give those passengers names, get to know them. So that passenger in my book, the passenger that says, if I miss this problem, I'll miss the next one, that's called Leapfrog. So if they get to know Leapfrog, then they can identify it quicker when it starts to arise. And that means they can stop taking instructions from it. They don't have to operate from that place of fear and stress.
They could just look at it and say, ah, it's you again.
Exactly. And there's such a critical moment in the tone that you use when you say, ah, it's you again. So if that tone is, oh, hell, it's you again, I don't want you here, I wish you weren't, I wish you didn't talk, then you're just creating an adverse relationship with part of yourself. And that creates more distraction and stress. So the most difficult and crucial part of this entire framework is finding and realizing and acting from a place of knowing that the passengers have good intentions. So there are exercises on finding the good intentions of a passenger, even a passenger that says, you suck, you're not good at taking tests. That passenger has a good intention. If you look hard enough, it always does.
Yeah, you compare it to a coach who's being, you know, a little harsh on an athlete who's not performing.
Right. If students look hard enough, they'll resist at first, but if they keep asking, why are you telling me I suck? Inevitably, it'll get to a place of, well, because I don't want you to fail.
Now, I'm going to break in right here because at this point of the interview, things went slightly off the rails. In the book, Thompson talks about an acronym for a mindfulness technique called TAILS, T-A-I-L-S. I kind of lost it at that point because for the life of me, I could not spell TAILS while asking the question, and I started laughing. Once we got back on track, Thompson couldn't remember what all of the letters stood for off the top of his head, and again, we started laughing. I assured him when we regained our composure that I could edit all of that tomfoolery out, but he had a different idea.
You know what? This might actually be worth airing because, a bunch of passengers started to flood me like, oh no, you're irresponsible. How could you have forgotten that? My body started flooding with cortisol. Yeah, and this could derail an entire performance. Honestly, this is really apt about what I'm talking about.
Huh. Well, let's talk about the solutions then. Tails, take a moment.
Yeah. So in this moment, as I'm stressed because I forgot something in my own book, I can either keep panicking and spinning about how it feels and that I'm inadequate and all that stuff, or I can enact TAILS, my own advice. And T in TAILS stands for take a moment. And all that means is hitting a brief pause button and taking a breath. And that's it. It's just taking a pause in the action. And then anchor, it's a tool to bring me back to this present moment because my mind is really trying to pull me back to that story of my own inadequacy. How could I have forgotten? But if I feel what my feet feel like on the floor, then I have to be in this present moment, and it keeps me from spinning out, listening to the passengers and so forth. So now I feel a little bit more grounded. I know where I am. And then I have to have a little bit of interest and investigation about what's happening. I can have interest in, oh, wow, look, my mind's trying to spin out a little bit more. And I can listen. That's the L. I can listen to these passengers, what they're trying to tell me. The only reason I felt all of that fear is because I wanted to be on my best performance, not because I'm terrible or whatever these passengers are telling me. And then the S, the self-kindness, allows me to continue going forward. It adds a little bit of resilience. It's accessing the driver to say, you know what, everybody makes mistakes. And that allows that whole TAILS process only takes like a minute or two, but it leaves me in a place of being able to re-engage with the process in front of me, whether that being a test or difficult conversation, studying, anything. People should know, if they're going to try to practice mindfulness, they should know two things. One, if you're thinking it's not wrong or bad, it doesn't mean you're not practicing mindfulness correctly. Often I'll have students who say, oh, I don't know how to practice because my mind thinks a lot. And that's totally fine. The mind is supposed to think. As long as we notice the thoughts, we're being mindful. The thoughts and emotions that arise don't necessarily do so because we ask them to. They're not our fault. When we have these voices come up and say messages that we don't like, we're not alone. A lot of people are having these thoughts. And they're not our fault. They just occur. They're flickers of the mind, like you said.
Again, the name of Logan Thompson's new book is Beyond the Content, Mindfulness as a Test Prep Advantage. Still to come, some students in Western New York found a unique way to support Alzheimer's research. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Three students from Mount St. Mary Academy High School in a suburb of Buffalo, New York, have created a special activity book for those living with Alzheimer's disease. From station WBFO, senior reporter Eileen Buckley says as part of the school's Entrepreneurs program, the students published a book called Forget Me Not.
Both of my great-grandmothers passed away from Alzheimer's.
Clarice Scarpacci is a senior at Mount St. Mary Academy. She came up with the idea to create an activity book for Alzheimer patients after her family experienced the disease.
Coming up with this idea really is not only, I think, helping with Alzheimer's across the board, but it's really been nice for my family and for me especially to have seen what Alzheimer's can do, but has also been been able to develop something that can help other patients.
We all have someone in our lives who suffered with Alzheimer's, and we knew we all wanted to make a difference for people with Alzheimer's.
Senior Amanda Ackley and Amelia Wydell learned about Scarpacey's idea and wanted to jump on board to help develop her concept. Both students also had family members who suffered from Alzheimer's.
And my great-grandma, she recently passed in March from it, and she was, like, so excited about this coloring book.
My great-aunt Daisy, she's still alive.
But creating the cognitive coloring book wasn't a quick process. They began this project when they were in their second year of high school.
And we started research and getting it all together, and all of the pages in there we drew ourselves, and we have journals and puzzles and word searches, all with the goal to hopefully start a conversation between the patients and their loved ones or their caretakers.
The word searches have like specific words in there that you would encounter in your everyday life or you would have in your memory, like from school or like from family members and things like that. So it's just to spur memories and create like good conversation between the patient and their loved ones.
It's been a really great experience for all of us. We've really become great leaders throughout of it. We've learned how to like speak to people and promote our book. And all our profits go to the Alzheimer's Association, and then we keep the other profits to reprint our books.
The students work directly with the Alzheimer's Association. Scarpacey says the organization supported their project, guided them on content, and then they appeared before the board for approval.
And they flipped through our prototype of our book, and we sat there watching them, waiting to see what they thought. And as soon as they finished, they just said a couple changes of the wording of our mission statement, and everything else they thought looked great. Well, so we were really, really excited.
It's like a Shark Tank episode.
Yes, it really felt like a Shark Tank episode.
And with that approval, the Alzheimer's Association actually has their logo on the back of Forget-Me-Nots.
It's really incredible to see my students come up with an idea and really see it through to the end.
Teacher Kelsey Novitz also co-teaches in the Academy Scholars Program, where students conduct entrepreneur work. She called this project incredible.
They really did their research. They really looked into the background of it. And I think just having that personal connection is really a driving force. Something we've been talking about lately is how the book can help a family member connect with the member of their family that has Alzheimer's. And actually, it can serve as a way to sit down with that person and connect and talk about memories and see what comes up.
And while recording interviews with the students, that's when they learned their website, ForgetMeNotColoringBook.com, went live.
Oh my gosh.
I'm so cool.
Here it is.
I'm so proud of you. You girls sound very excited about this.
Yeah, we are very excited about this. It's been a long road here.
Yeah.
It is their goal to get into nursing care facilities and hospitals with their book. Students have already worked with some patients at the Weinberg campus.
And that story comes to us from Eileen Buckley in Buffalo, New York. Pathology laboratories in the United States have to be inspected and certified to continue serving the patients and professionals who rely on these labs for test results. One agency that continues to certify labs is the College of American Pathologists. They've been in the certification business for 56 years. Baptist Hospital Laboratory in Pensacola, Florida, has been certified again as best in pathology by the CAP. They are one of just 41 laboratories across the country to meet the rigorous standards of the College of American Pathologists accreditation each year since the standards were set back in 1963. I recently visited that lab and spoke with Jan Byard, the interim corporate director for Baptist Hospital Laboratory, about just what it takes to keep that certification current.
CAP is the gold standard for laboratory accreditation, and it's a vigorous many questions and standards that we have to follow, and we get accredited every 2 years. They come in with a team of inspectors. Usually we have about 10, 11 people that come and interact with all our departments and make sure that we're doing everything up to the CAP standard. So we've been doing this since 1963, so greater than 50 years, 56 years. And I asked CAP, when did they start accrediting labs? And it was in 1963, so we were one of the first labs that joined them. You can be accredited by other accrediting agency, but CAP is probably the most rigorous and keeps us to the best quality we can be. All hospitals have to be accredited by somebody to perform laboratory medicine, so you have to have some sort of accreditation. And most of the larger institutions are CAP accredited. We just happen to have been with them much longer than most. So the list that they sent out, it wasn't a very long list of people that had been in the whole country that had been accredited more than 50 years. So that was kind of an accomplishment.
And you're one of four in Florida.
Yeah.
Jackson Memorial, Miami, Mount Sinai, Miami Beach, and Lakeland Regional.
Good company. Yeah.
Talk about the pathology lab. What goes on there? What kind of tests? How would that interact with a patient?
Well, everything, when you come to the hospital or your doctor and something's wrong and they ask you to get lab work performed, blood work, urine samples, anything like that, comes to our laboratory, and then we do whatever the doctor ordered. So any of the testing for anything like anemia, check your electrolytes to see if, you know, your chemistries are in balance, your analysis. If you have any kind of infection, like you think you have strep throat, we do that here. So it's very diverse, but it's pretty much everything that your doctor orders from that standpoint, it would come to a laboratory to be tested. And they also, we have a pathology section that is more for determining if potentially if you have some kind of cancer or that kind of thing, like you have an actual biopsy done, then that would be performed in that section. It's very extensive. It's more than most people. When they think of a lab, I don't think most people understand how big and diverse it is. They think someone just draws their blood and then the one person's back there running everything. But we have over, counting our outreach and everything, probably about 150 people who work here.
Are they all laboratorians?
No, about 60 to 70 are actual medical technologists and laboratorians that are performing the test. But we have phlebotomists who go and draw the blood and bring it back to us, and so there's a big team to get it all done.
What does this lab look like now that was different than what it looked like 20 years ago?
I guess the standard nowadays is to have more and more automation so you can have less people. You require less humans to run it basically nowadays so you can be more efficient. So it's gone from, I'm sure way back then, this is thankfully before my time, where they were actually, you know, using beakers and setting up and, you know, checking your glucose very primitive methods to an automated analyzer where we just put the sample on and it just takes it from there and runs everything. So there's lots and lots of instrumentation to do all the work that we do back there. So it takes a lot less people to run it. And we can run thousands of tests in several hours instead of what used to be done 40 years ago.
You're not dipsticking too much anymore.
No, we still have, if our urinalysis equipment breaks, we still have dipsticks to do that with. But no, everything's pretty automated now. Like I said, for the chemistry analysis, we spin down the blood and just put the serum on there and it pretty much knows what to do and run. And then a medical technologist reviews the results before releasing it to make sure they're good results.
When people hear pathology, they obviously go toward autopsies or things like that. Is that anything that's done here?
We do very few, but we do perform autopsies if requested or if there was a need that has to be, but there's not really that many that go on nowadays. I guess there's so much other things you can do nowadays to see what happened to a person, you know, when they pass, that they don't need to do it all the time anymore. But we do have the ability to do that here if it's requested.
Is this just for Baptist patients?
We have a very large outreach program, so we're actually from Mobile to Destin. We draw for nursing homes and doctor's offices, and so we bring the samples in here every night and perform all the blood work for them too. So, and we also, our lab, we're affiliated with Gulf Breeze and Jay Hospital Lab, and we do work for them that they don't, like, they're smaller labs, so if they don't have the type of testing we do before it gets sent to a reference lab, we would do it for them. So we're kind of like a mini reference lab ourselves. Most people don't know what a medical technologist does. They don't even know that exists. And that we're very important that I would say 60-70% of what a doctor needs to diagnose their patients and take care of their patients are performed by medical technologists. So without us and radiology, that's the whole, you know, what is needed to take care of people and basically just the unsung heroes, the unknown people down here. And so that's, I guess, it.
One other question, and this is something that people are going to want to know because they watch CSI all the time. Do you work with law enforcement at all?
Indirectly, we do. We do get samples. If something happens, like someone comes in and has a car accident or there was any kind of like alcohol or drugs involved, that we do, they will have drug screens done here or alcohol testing, and then the policeman will ask us for our results, or just we save samples for them to take back to their labs to do more testing to see if the person was under the influence when it happened. So we do quite often get visits from police officers regarding that kind of thing. But it's not quite as cool as CSI. I love that show.
Jan Byard is the interim corporate director for Baptist Hospital Laboratory. Could those pathology labs one day be running tests looking for an autism biomarker? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Diagnosing autism earlier could make life easier for children and their parents. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Rajesh Khanna, associate professor of psychology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, explores the search for a faster diagnosis.
Autism diagnosis is still a fairly slow process that involves observing a child's behavior and interviewing the parents. The delay in getting a diagnosis is a major concern. It would be better if we could find reliable and stable biological markers for autism. This would help doctors and other professionals diagnose autism earlier in life so that social and educational interventions with children can begin at younger ages. My laboratory uses MRI imaging techniques to search for brain-based markers of autism. Changes in brain function, anatomy, and brain chemistry, as well as changes in the strength of connections between different areas of the brain. We study large amounts of neuroimaging data to find features and patterns that are characteristic of the autistic brain. These features can then be tested for their ability to distinguish autism and healthy control participants with accuracy, sensitivity, and reliability. We recently found differences in the communication or connectivity between the cerebral cortex and two deep regions of the brain in children with autism. The unimodal area involved in sensation was overconnected with the cortex, and the supramodal area involved in thinking was underconnected in autism. This finding reports an important feature, although it's not yet used for classification and may not be powerful enough for diagnosis. But it is a step forward in our effort to find the signature of autism and understand why people with the disorder show certain social and behavioral symptoms. How the structure and function of the brain are affected can help us understand why people with autism are different.
That was Rajesh Khanna of the University of Alabama, Birmingham. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.